loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, a meeting between Donald Trump and top congressional Democrats over the federal budget was abruptly canceled today, making a government shutdown even more likely. Meanwhile, taxes, the DREAM Act, and other key priorities are piling up in what is shaping up to be a make-or-break moment for the Trump administration. Then new footage of slave markets in Libya are sparking outrage and protest across the globe. More than 6 years since the NATO-backed overthrow of the Libyan government, chaos continues to reign in what was once one of the most developed countries in Africa. And then, is Palestinian unity finally at hand as Hamas is scheduled to hand over administration of Gaza to the Palestinian Authority this week? But there are still serious obstacles in the way to lasting reunification. But first, we turn to a very, very big day for Donald Trump and his administration in Washington. A meeting between Trump and top congressional Democrats over the federal budget was abruptly canceled today, making a government shutdown even more likely. Meanwhile, taxes, the DREAM Act, and other key priorities are piling up in what is shaping to be a make-or-break moment for the Trump administration. We're joined from New York by award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist Ted Rall. We're joined from New York by Pete Dalek. He is an organizer with the Trade Justice New York Metro and the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. And we're joined from Amsterdam by Steve Keen. He is the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowd-funded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Welcome, gentlemen.
Glad to be here, Brian.
Good to be here.
Hey, Brian.
Thank you. Ted, let's start with you. Is this a make or break day for Donald Trump?
One of many. It seems like every day is just more chaos with this guy. And he does seem to have more lives than a cat, so I'll give him that. And expectations are so low at this point, and that he appears to have hit his absolute bottom in terms of his popularity, his approval rating, that he's got that 35% of the electorate, and they don't seem to be going anywhere. I think even nuclear war won't, and a government shutdown together are not going to dent the 30% mark for whatever reason. So I don't think it's make or break, but it is just another road on the brick in the wall, to paraphrase Pink Floyd.
Steve Keen, MSNBC had a very interesting poll this morning showing that that Donald Trump has a rating of 50%, who think that he's doing a very bad job. So it's very good, good, undecided, bad, or very bad. 50% said very bad. What makes it even more interesting is that it's been scientifically proven that short of a war, it's impossible for a person to go from very bad to good. People just don't change their minds that much.
Are you predicting war?
No. Well, I'm not going to say.
It helped George W. Bush a great deal at first,
and then he collapsed. With that said, Donald Trump left the White House around noon to go to Capitol Hill and to negotiate with the Democrats. What he did just before leaving for the White House was to insult the Democrats on Twitter, and so the Democrats pulled out of the meeting. What good can come of this visit to Capitol Hill today when the president is only going to be talking to the one side, and that's the side that's going to do what he wants anyway?
Yeah, well, I think people make the mistake of seeing Trump as somebody who's negotiating. He's actually bullying. There's a fascinating exchange where he was talking to, I've forgotten, a trade negotiator of some sort long before he even decided to run for president. And he said his idea about negotiating was to turn up late to the meeting, substantially late, and then march in. And I won't use the four-letter word he he prefaced his comments with, he walk up right up to the person you're talking to, hit him in the chest with a finger and say, F dot, 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 you, and start the negotiations from that point of view. So he's trying to bully his way in this situation. And partly what he'd be doing, of course, if the government shutdown does occur, he'll blame the Democrats. And that plays right to his base, which is really the only system your party understands. Those are the people who are wedded to him being the human hand grenade they've thrown into Washington. It'll strengthen his hand with them, and he thinks it'll bully the Democrats into giving way.
You know, Brian, you and I were talking off the air about previous government shutdowns. This is something that historically the Republicans have been very bad at, and that's been managing government shutdowns. For whatever reason, perhaps it's because they live in this bubble on Capitol Hill, they think that they can shut down the government and not pay a political price for it. I told you a story that when I was working overseas in an American embassy, Americans would call and say, oh, I need a birth certificate. I need to register a foreign birth. I need a visa for my friend. And we would say, sorry, we're closed. Call Newt Gingrich's office. Well, that made people angry, not at us, but at the Republicans.
That was the mid-90s.
There have been three recent government shutdowns. That one went for 2 weeks. Another one went for a week. And the truth is, the government doesn't save any money by shutting itself down. Everybody in the government, even those who didn't work, and most don't work during shutdowns, they still get paid retroactively. So nothing good comes out of a government shutdown. And if you look historically, it's the Republicans who pay a political price for it.
Pete Dolak, I know in our discussions with you over the months and earlier in your own writings that a case could be made that there's not a big difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. There are differences, but on fundamental big issues, pro-Wall Street, pro-military industrial complex, pro-conglomeration of media, pro-censorship, pro-surveillance state. So is this just much ado about nothing, or is the current sort of gridlock in Washington regarding issues of the budget in particular or the tax reform bill something that has significance politically and socially for society, or can the sort of internal war here in Washington have some larger impact, and what do you expect will happen?
Well, it's hard to say what's going to happen because we're dealing with Donald Trump, who doesn't have any plan. I mean, if there is any logic, and that's we use if hesitantly here, it's simply, as was stated earlier, he just likes to throw red meat to his base, and I don't think he seems to have any plan much beyond that, and that seems like that's what's going on with his insults this morning. Certainly not a good negotiating tactic. As far as what's going on in Washington, you know, a lot of this is political maneuvering. A lot of it is just my team, rah, 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 and your team, boo. And what does it all mean? It's kind of hard to say. I think at this point that the Republican budget proposal are just simply so extreme that the Democrats can't swallow it because the base would rise up in protest if they didn't stand up to this. Now, how firm will they actually stand up as we get into December and the deadline for averting a government shutdown looms? It's really hard to say. One uses the words Democratic Party and backbone in the same sentence, that one's risk. So it's really hard to see how it's going to do. I think the Democrats will show a little bit more spine than they ordinarily would be, simply because they've got to keep their base at least a little bit happy. They can't completely abandon their base. And obviously, it's easier to stand together when you're in opposition than it is when you're in governance, as, of course, the Republican Party has found out this past year.
Let's talk about why the government might shut down. What are the basic issues here, just so the audience understands? Does Trump actually need the Democrats?
I think he probably needs a couple of votes because there are a few Republicans, the relatively moderate ones, who seem to be wavering. Supposedly Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, two of the more hardline Republicans, who nonetheless seem to dislike Trump on a personal basis anyway. seem to be wavering a little bit. But let's face it, Corker and Flake, for all their fine words about what a bad human being or how nasty Donald Trump is, they vote with him 100% of the time. So the Republicans' problems with Trump aren't over issues, or certainly aren't over substance. It's just merely a matter of style. You know, the Republicans have really learned to use code words and to use somewhat subtle languages, whereas Trump just says it out straight. And while the base might like that, the Republican the Republican Party as a whole knows that's not really a best strategy. So really, it's a matter of style, not all about substance. And I think the idea that the Republicans are going to agree to impeach Trump is frankly a fantasy right now. Trump is just simply too useful for them. I think they see this is their last best chance to get through as much of their reactionary hard right ideology through as they possibly can.
Let me ask Ted Rall about this too. You know, Ted, this is a valid point that for all their words and for all their purported dislike of Donald Trump, these Republican senators generally fall right into line. You know, it's one thing for Jeff Flake to have a press conference or Bob Corker to have a press conference and criticize Trump. When push comes to shove and they go to the floor of the Senate, they vote for Trump. So what's to stop these same Republicans from, you know, falling right into line as they're told to do, especially on budget bills that are coming up?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely a really important point to remember. I mean, let's remember Trump's biggest loss to date, which is his failure to repeal Obamacare. That just barely failed, and you could argue that it's because he insulted John McCain's war service, and that McCain was holding a grudge, and he decided to vote against it. You know, only Senator McCain knows why he did that. But the point is, it just barely failed in the Senate. These Republicans do fall into line. The difference with this budget fiasco is that the Republicans can't do it alone. They need 60 votes in the Senate, not 50 votes, to pass this budget by December 8th. So they're up against the wall, and they're going to need some Democratic votes in order to avoid this shutdown. We need to hearken back to a word that we probably hoped never to hear again, sequester. But this is a hangover of the sequester, where spending is essentially frozen, and the Republicans want to exempt military spending, which is a sizable portion of the federal budget, depending on how you look at it, roughly a quarter. They want to exempt that from the sequester, and Democrats are trying to they say they'll go along with that if there's something done about the Dreamers, and if Trump retracts his threat to cut the CHIPS program. So that's kind of where we are. It's wheeling and dealing. If anything, there's really no glory here for much of anyone. The Republicans are falling in lockstep, including those who complain about Trump behind closed doors. And frankly, Democrats should not have come to this negotiating table in such a weak position in the first place. It's nice that they grew a spine after reading Trump's Twitter feed this morning, but they shouldn't have shown up in the first place, because there's really no reason for them to negotiate.
No, they get nothing out of it.
Steve Keen, let's talk about both the budget as it's shaping up and also the tax reform plan. You're an economist. You would think that the politicians who are elected to represent the people would be wanting to do things that would, quote, help the people. Now, in the United States, wage stagnation is a dominant part of the problem. And you have, you know, we have a situation here now where three individuals have the equivalent wealth of 46% of the population. In other words, there's class polarization, income inequality, wage stagnation, a kind of poverty that doesn't go away. How does the tax plan impact people? Not, you know, let's talk about the different sectors of the people. We have the people, the broad mass of the population, those whose wages have stagnated. Then you have the upper middle class, let's say the top 20%. And then we have the 1% or the 0.001%. The big guys. Talk about what this would mean and what the Democrats are saying or doing or not doing about it.
It says taxes fund government spending. So if we stop taxing, the government can't spend. And that's actually categorically wrong. This is one point that modern monetary theory has been trying to get through for a long time. The government creates its own money. It's the only institution that owns its own bank. So it doesn't tax because it needs the money. It taxes because if it didn't tax the money out of existence that it spends into existence, there'd be rampant inflation. So it's really about controlling that. That's the role of taxation. And what you have with the uber wealthy, like Trump and his friends doing, is they're making sure the money that's created by the government ends up in their pockets and doesn't get back into distribution with the rest of us. So I think the whole focus on tax policy is wrong. I'd rather be saying let's virtually abolish income tax. Let's change over and have a transactions tax that the rich can't evade and stop the money accumulating in their pockets. But of course, instead we have this entire debate that argues the government has to tax to raise the money, and therefore if we cut the taxes, the government won't have the money to spend. Yes, it will. It can create that money. It can spend. And if it did do that, if Trump cut back on taxes drastically while still not cutting government spending as much, that would actually be a massive stimulus for the economy. And there are, even though the unemployment figures look extremely good, when you look at the employment rate, we still know there's about 3 million Americans who had jobs back in 2000 who don't have them now. So there's room for this to actually work in Trump's favor. He's not aware of that, of course. So I saw quite a few of the newspapers are saying he's playing a zero strategy step chess game here. But fundamentally, if he'd actually went with his bluster and cut the taxes dramatically and maintained the spending, it actually boosts the economy.
A very interesting point of view, because the Republicans, who are called the deficit hawks, Steve Keen, they're not happy about the budget, because with the lowering of taxes for the corporate tax rate for the very rich, I think the taxes for the people making under $30,000 or a lower level might actually go up over the next decade. But their argument is that this would create a $1.4 or $1.5 trillion budget deficit. But what you're saying is that that's actually not a problem.
Government money creation program. We call it debt. What if we call it equity? Would anybody complain that America has too much equity? It's literally an intellectual thought exercise about how we classify the asset side of the government book. Because when the government issues these bonds to finance their spending, they could equally be issuing shares. In fact, this has just been argued by the Bank of England, that the government could finance itself by issuing shares, which gave a fixed dividend. And then you'd be saying, oh, we've got too high a level of equity in this country. All of a sudden, it doesn't make the sense. It's really the negative connotations of the word debt. Debt is the sort of thing you and I need to worry about, because you and I don't own our own bank. But the government doesn't have that worry. So if we actually redefined it and said it's creating equity by spending more than it gets back in taxation and pumping that equity into the society, we wouldn't have these ridiculous conflagrations on Capitol Hill.
Very interesting, John. And of course, the problem with the debt ceiling, which of course, if you use Steve Keen's language of an equity ceiling, would make no sense whatsoever, and because right. It would turn equity into something negative. I mean, in other words, it's definitional. That's an artificial construct too. I mean,
it is. It's an artificial political issue. And what was very funny to me was how during the Obama administration, Republicans just lined up to vote no on an increase in the debt ceiling. And it became a legitimate political issue where work couldn't get done because we couldn't raise the debt ceiling. And the very moment that Donald Trump was elected president, it was the Republicans who lined up to vote for an increase in the debt ceiling. And now the Democrats, who are somehow suddenly opposed to it.
And Pete Dolek, back when Obama was president, I can remember when the Republicans were lining up to vote no and threatening to shut down the government. And there was a compromise made by Obama where he came into one of the meetings with Boehner and said, OK, you pass the budget and I'll give you abortion in D.C., meaning that poor women who are getting D.C. money, because the D.C. council, unlike the federal government, was prepared to provide subsidies or social relief for poor women who needed abortion or wanted an abortion. So Obama was willing to horse trade away that right for poor women in the District of Columbia. And here you have on the other side now the Democrats saying, well, give us the Dream Act, meaning give us this the right of these 800,000, 900,000 young people or people who were very, very, very young when they came to the United States as undocumented kids, the right to not be deported. And in exchange, the Republicans, who are so fearsome about immigration and against anyone who breaks an immigration law, will go along with that, perhaps, in exchange for a budget that is a big tax giveaway to the rich and for the military contractors. Pete Dulla, go ahead.
I think you've summed it up well there. Is this going to be horse trading? Was that the reason why Schumer and Pelosi were willing to go speak with Trump this afternoon before they canceled the meeting? Now, obviously, something like the DREAM Act ought to be considered and ought to be passed and ought to be implemented on its own, without you know, horse trading away other things. So is that the Democratic strategy? Okay, they can go to their base and say, hey, look, we saved the Dreamers. Look, we're going to let all these young people stay in the country. And, oh, well, you know, so what? We're going to cut all kinds of programs for you. That would be a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, just look at some of the cuts. I was looking into it. Global warming, they're going to get they're going to spend $1.6 billion on global warming programs. That's going to be cut in its entirety. $500 million on earth science missions, five of them, they're all going to be cut. $5 billion in cuts to health and human services, $4 billion to housing and urban development, cuts eliminating the Chemical Safety Board, massive cuts to Legal Aid Corporation that provides free lawyers to people who are poor and can't afford a lawyer of their own. And, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg there. I mean, you know, at what price do we do this kind of horse trading? It's really hard to say because I'm not sure the Democrats know what they're going to do. I mean, we've been seeing what's going on. We saw the results of 2016, where the Democratic Party did everything they could to shove aside Bernie Sanders. We just now saw something of a progressive upsurge in the elections of earlier this month. And yet the Democratic Party seems to not learn any lessons. They're still trying to purge their progressive wing. They're still trying to be the party of centrism, the party of Wall Street. It's a party that just doesn't seem to learn anything. They seem to have the attitude of, well, the demographics are on our side, so we just got to wait and bide our time. Well, the demographics are going in their favor, but if you don't get your base out, the demographics don't do you just good, a lesson they learned the hard way last year.
And there's the rub right there. You have a Democratic Party leadership that is not thinking strategically, not thinking over the long term, and is weak. You know, there are protestations to the contrary. I think that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are actually afraid of Donald Trump. They talk tough, but I think they're afraid. If they weren't afraid, they would go to the table with real issues, not we'll trade you relief for the Dreamers in exchange for exempting, for example, the Pentagon budget from sequestration. That's not a win. Maybe you help some of the Dreamers, but overall, that's a loss. That's a loss for the country. They're too willing to give big things up too quickly.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Ted Rall, when you think about the last year, we've had Donald Trump as president now for almost a year. It'll be January 20th will be the anniversary. So about 2 months to go, 7 weeks to go. But when the media commentary is talking about him, they're saying, well, Donald Trump hasn't actually accomplished any of his so-called goals. He didn't get to build a wall in Mexico and make Mexico pay for it. He didn't get to repeal and replace Obamacare. But that said, when you look at the last year, there have been a number of negative things that Donald Trump has succeeded in. The partial sabotage of the Affordable Care Act. He's trashed U.S.-Cuban relations that Obama had started to normalize somewhat. Trashing the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal. While he didn't get the Muslim ban passed by the courts, there's a lot of restrictions going on. And even for visas, but even more important, a 40% increase in the number of people who have been arrested by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. There's a reign of terror going on against immigrants. In the state of Georgia, an 80% increase of working class families. I mean, people who were lured to Georgia to help with unmet labor needs in Georgia, especially in construction and agriculture. People are now just being rounded up. So Trump actually has accomplished something, but it's all been negative. The tax bill, the tax plan, he wants to be able to say, this is something positive. This will be a real accomplishment. Do you see this tax bill passing?
It's not as much of a it's not as doomed, obviously doomed, as the Obamacare repeal effort was. But I'm going to have to, if I'm forced to predict this, I don't think it's going to pass. It just doesn't seem. It seems like once again you have too many divisions within the Republican Party. They're not going to be able to hold their conference together. There's a split between the corporatist wing and the populist wing, and I think it's going to be hard for the Senate and the House to reconcile. The plan seems to be to try to jam the Senate bill through the House, but it's hard for me to imagine the House going with such a Wall Street centric Senate plan that we're seeing that seems to be about to emerge. So I'm going to say probably not.
And Steve Keen, you're an economist, and we have about 3 minutes left. When you look at this budget proposal, does it constitute, I don't know, Robin Hood in reverse, take from the poor, give to the rich? Is it?
Oh, it certainly is, because we've had such a capacity for the wealthy to evade taxes, and now it's saying let's cut the level of taxes they need to evade. But they're all being extremely successful in relocating their income into offshore islands and so on. So it's certainly a victory for them. I actually think it will go through. I think that Trump will, the Democrats will probably attenuate some part of the program. You'll get the Dreamer Act as well, and there'll be some sort of compromise where Trump manages to claim victory and still criticize the Democrats. And maybe one half of the changes will go through. Maybe the corporate changes won't occur, but the income tax changes will. So he'll pull something off and turn it into a victory and blame the Democrats in the process, and this horrible melee will continue.
Yeah, Pete Dalek, we have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you and Ted in the last 2 minutes, so limit your answer, if you would, to about 1 minute. If this goes through, well, what seems to me is that there hasn't been a lot of mobilization from grassroots organizations or from labor regarding this budget, even though it's going to be, I mean, this tax plan, even if it goes through as Steve Keen is predicting it might. And I sort of lean in that direction, too. It's going to do a lot of damage to the majority of the population at the benefit of the already very, very rich.
No doubt about that. The damage is going to be immense to working people, poorer people, middle class people, everybody in between. And to the environment and to so much more. You know, every time a new Republican regime comes into power after the last one, you think, it can't even get any worse. And then, sure enough, you get worse. After Bush, we thought it couldn't get worse, but this is even worse. Yeah, there's no alternative to everybody getting onto the street. I'm all for calling your congressmen and your senators. Great, do that too. But without mass mobilization, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. No doubt about it. We have our work cut out for us.
Ted Rall, we give you the last word, about 45 seconds.
Couldn't agree more, but there's still no sign of mass mobilization whatsoever. I mean, we're talking about a resistance that peaked out one day into the Trump regime with the Women's March on January 21st. And where has the street mobilization been since then? I think I'm old enough to remember growing up in Dayton, Ohio, during the Vietnam War, and there were war protests all the time. It was hardly a hotbed of activism, and it was constant, it was relentless. The left needs to get out into the streets, it needs to do grassroots organizing, and it needs to do it yesterday.
Yeah, I agree. And right now, for the last, maybe since January 21st, so many people have become spectators watching the Democrats accuse Trump of being a stooge for the Russians rather than paying attention, say, to the mass arrests of immigrants or the budget or the tax bill. Anyway, I agree with you completely, Ted Rall. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a very short break. We'll be back. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
New footage of the slave markets in Libya are sparking outrage and protest across the globe. More than 6 years since the NATO-backed overthrow of the Libyan government, chaos continues to reign in what was once the most developed country in Africa. We're joined from New York by Ben Norton. He is a journalist for Alternet's Gray Zone Project and co-host of the Moderate Rebels podcast. You can find his writings on bennorton.com. Ben, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Always glad to be here.
Ben, when this story first broke, I shared pictures that had been floating around the internet on Facebook. And as you, I'm sure, could guess, people were outraged. These are very graphic pictures that many people, many Americans have already seen. One person made a comment and he said, yeah, this is terrible, but what can we do about it? And I had no answer. What can we do about it?
Well, unfortunately, at this point, it's not really a matter of what we can do. It's what we should have done in the past. And what we can do is prevent this from happening again in the future. And of course, I mean, there are actions we can take. You know, the Libyan authorities that do exist in, you know, different competing parts of the country are ostensibly taking some kind of action. But the real controversy and scandal about all of this, which is never acknowledged. And in fact, I have an article that will be coming out for the media watchdog Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, doing a kind of scientific analysis of the media's complete failure to acknowledge this. And that is the role of NATO, and particularly the US, France, the UK, and Canada, in destabilizing Libya in 2011, just 6 years ago. And this has largely been erased from the picture. You know, we have all of these horrific stories that are covering the rise of slavery inside Libya. And of course, it's very important that people know about this. But what I've detailed in my article, and what is, you know, pretty obvious just from reading many of these reports, is that virtually none of them mention the 2011 war in Libya, let alone NATO's role in that war. And for, you know, some historical context for listeners, in 2011, you know, there were protests going on inside Libya. I mean, there were protests going on in multiple countries throughout the Middle East and North Africa. Of course, the U.S. did not support the protests in its allied countries like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain. In fact, Bahrain was invaded by Saudi Arabia to crush the protests. But the U.S. did support protests in countries that were enemies like Libya and Syria. And on March 19th, 2011, ostensibly for humanitarian reasons, although that is certainly not true, NATO militarily intervened in Libya with the express goal of overthrowing the government of Muammar Gaddafi. And of course, this is the situation we're in today. I mean, there's a lot more we can talk about the particular details, but what we can do to answer your question is prevent more Libyas from being created by opposing these wars of regime change that destabilize entire parts of the world that just so happen to be oil rich in the case of Libya, that destroy functioning governments that, as you mentioned, were some of the most stable in the region. I mean, in the case of Libya, Libya had one of the highest standards of living on the entire African continent. And now it's a complete failed state. And there are three competing governments, extremist groups control part of the country. There are warlords. I mean, that's what we can do, is prevent more Libyas from being created by opposing these wars of regime change and these military interventions.
John, you know, when we think back about how the U.S. got involved in Libya, or how it's involved in Iraq, or how it's involved in Afghanistan, one thing that really comes out is that even though each of the interventions by the United States is given some sort of noble cause, in the case of Libya, Resolution 1973 that was adopted by the UN Security Council, Russia and China abstained, sadly, authorized the use of force to protect civilians. Those were civilians in the eastern part of the country in Benghazi. But if you look back, the United States has been targeting the government in Libya, that government, the Gaddafi government, since 1981 when Ronald Reagan became president.
I would say even farther back, ever since the overthrow of King Idris in 1969, we had a hostile position, a hostile policy toward the Libyan government. It really began during the Nixon administration and then got worse under Reagan.
Yeah, Gaddafi and the revolution had closed down the Wheeler Air Base,
that's right.
I believe.
Yes.
And in other words, the U.S. lost a colonial outpost. So then we have the United States government in 1986, April 15th, bombing Libya, bombing the Tripoli. Lots of people were killed, scores of people, supposedly in retaliation for a bombing in a West German discotheque.
That's right.
In 2003, George W. Bush, though, after the Iraq invasion, signed an agreement with Gaddafi. Gaddafi, the Libyan government, would give up its weapons of mass destruction in exchange, presumably, for peace with the West. Ben Norton, Libya gave up its weapons of mass destruction, and then, you know, 8 years later, it wasn't much later, 8 years later, 2011, U.S., Britain, France, they could come in and just bomb that country mercilessly, and Libya actually had no air defense.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the lesson that other countries throughout the world have seen. And, you know, there's all this discussion of Iran. First of all, Iran never had a nuclear weapons program. But even if it were pursuing one, when it looks at neighbors, I mean, it's not very close, but, you know, relative regional neighbors like Libya, this is, you know, countries like Iran, DPRK, they see what happened and they say, these are the only mechanisms by which we can defend ourselves from these foreign attacks. So, of course, for anyone who's interested in opposing nuclear proliferation and fighting for a more peaceful world, this is precisely the kind of thing that, despite the claims of humanitarian interventionists otherwise, this is actually what makes the world less safe and what makes the prospects of war more likely. But I think even before we move away from the particular details, I think we really need to just understand how scandalous this intervention was. Because, you know, of course, everything you mentioned is entirely, you know, on point and important. But looking just from 2011, this is actually well documented at this point. Last year in 2016, the British Parliament's House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, which is a bipartisan committee, released a detailed investigation that they had conducted for more than a year and a half into the intervention in Libya. And they acknowledged a lot of inconvenient truths. One, they acknowledged that many of the media myths about Gaddafi, the claims he was going to massacre civilians, the claims he was giving his soldiers Viagra to rape women, those were totally false, even though they were widely reported throughout corporate media at the time. The British investigation also showed that from the very beginning in February, before the intervention even began, Islamist extremists played a big role in the opposition and were backed by NATO, including groups like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, a member of which, Shaman Abedi, actually blew himself up in Manchester and killed 24 civilians at a concert. He had been fighting in Libya under the aegis of NATO at the time. I mean, there are just so many controversies. Also, something that's really important to highlight is the extreme racism that was very clear at the time of Libyan rebels. And we're talking about, you know, these slave markets. Well, that doesn't just come out of nowhere. In fact, if you look back at 2011, in a few media reports every once in a while, they would acknowledge that some of the sectarian slogans of NATO-backed rebels were not just Islamist. They were also expressly anti-black. And there was actually a brigade in Misrata, which was the third largest city. It was a major rebel stronghold. And there was a brigade that called itself the Brigade for Purging Slaves and Black Skin. And there was ethnic cleansing of black Libyans and of African migrants and refugees inside Libya while NATO was carrying out the intervention on behalf of those rebels. So, of course, it's no surprise that after NATO helps overthrow and destabilize this government, now you have these extremist rebels who not only, you know, pursue these Salafi jihadist policies. And in the eastern part of the country, they've banned women from traveling on their own. But not just that. I mean, they've also implemented these extreme anti-black policies. They've brought back slavery. I mean, this should just be a ridiculous scandal. But of course, it's just ignored. The NATO role is ignored.
You're right.
And the thing is also that the liberal sector of the population, which was so vociferously opposed to George W. Bush's intervention in Iraq, has been basically silent about this intervention in Libya. I mean, I helped organize, as the director of the Answer Coalition, protests all over the country starting March 19th, 2011, when the NATO bombing of Libya began. And I have to tell you, unlike the Iraq War, where we had tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, we had hundreds, not thousands or tens of thousands. And most people just, they bought the demonization of Gaddafi so completely. And of course, it was a Democrat. It was Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, the one who the day this head of state, Gaddafi, 70-year-old man, was lynched, sodomized, lynched on the streets. She laughingly said, "Oh, we came, we saw, he died." So cavalierly, she's the chief diplomat of the United States. And during that entire time, you know, it was just okay to attack Gaddafi. And one of the things, John, that I think the American people don't know, including the liberals or the parts of the left don't know, is that Gaddafi was the champion of the OAU, the Organization of African Unity.
Yes, he was.
Libya had the largest oil deposits, oil reserves in Africa. It wasn't the largest oil producer. But in other words, it had a small population with a lot of oil and thus a lot of money. And Gaddafi was using that money to fund the OAU. In other words,
and using that money to help develop other African nations.
Yes. And so the black Libyans and the black African populations looked generally favorably at Gaddafi. And now you have, I'm looking at the pictures from Al Jazeera, pictures of entirely black people at an open air slave auction where people are being sold for $400. I mean, this is one of Ben Norton. This is one of the great crimes, I would say, of the modern times. And one, again, that because people bought the demonization, the targeting of Gaddafi, and you don't have to love Gaddafi or whatever. I mean, you could have all sorts of opinions, but we know the demonization of targeted leaders is done for no other reason than to prepare the population through the mechanism of hatred and fear for the U.S. to do whatever it's going to do to bomb or occupy a country. I mean, that's really what we're looking at. That should be an important lesson, I think. We have slavery now. We have slavery of black people in Libya again. What a turnaround.
This alone is just such an enormous scandal and is so criminal. But it's also just one of other factors as well. I mean, like I said, not only is there enslavement of African refugees, but there was mass ethnic cleansing of black Libyans who had been living inside Libya for many years. I mean, these weren't migrants. These were people of sub-Saharan descent who were living in Libya. And, you know, this is even clear from mainstream reports. So, for instance, Human Rights Watch, which is, you know, a pretty pro-U.S. human rights organization. And by the way, the executive director of which, Ken Roth, was a strong supporter of the NATO intervention in Libya. He wrote an article in Foreign Policy cheerleading it. Even Human Rights Watch has thoroughly documented Libyan rebels' ethnic cleansing of the town of Tawerga. And Tawerga was near Misrata. And if you read all these, even you can read mainstream media reports, it talks about how Misrata was largely controlled by white or lighter skinned rich families who were merchants. And then Tawerga was almost entirely black. And during the NATO intervention and immediately after, tens of thousands of Tawergans were ethnically cleansed. They were killed. They were imprisoned. They were beaten. They were tortured. And there's videos of them, of Libyan rebels forcing them to eat Libyan flags. I mean, this is well documented by mainstream organizations at this point. I mean, but the fact that it's been completely ignored, the fact that it's not mentioned when we're talking about these slave markets is just so scandalous. And we constantly hear, you know, from even United Nations officials, for instance, I was analyzing some of their statements, like Guterres, the new Secretary General. They will talk about slavery. They will talk about the chaos in Libya, but they won't mention any historical context. And they won't even mention what happened 6 years ago, let alone before that. But there's just so many layers of hypocrisy. I guess I'll add one other comment here that came to mind when you were speaking about, you know, Gaddafi and his relations with other countries. Ironically, during the so-called war on terror, Gaddafi said that, okay, well, if the U.S. is actually serious about fighting these Salafi jihadist extremists, then maybe we can collaborate a bit. And Libya participated in the CIA rendition program. Ironically, and I've actually documented this and I'm going to write more about it, some of the people that the U.S. and Libya collaborated with in the rendition program who were linked to Al-Qaeda, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, NATO then supported them in 2011 to overthrow Gaddafi.
They rendered them, the Libyan government participated in a CIA torture campaign, and then the U.S. rescued them and made them the new leadership
Insane. In
Libya. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined by Ben Norton. He's a journalist at Alternet's Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the Moderate Rebel podcast. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Palestinian unity may finally be at hand as Hamas is scheduled to hand over administration of Gaza to the Palestinian Authority this week. But there are still serious obstacles in the way to lasting reunification. We're joined from New York by Amina Al-Ashkar. She is a political analyst and part of the North American Nakba Tour. Welcome, Amina.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. We've talked about this on the show a couple of times, and you know, while this sounds like really great news from the headlines, you get down into some of these articles and you realize that not a lot is going to change. It looks like Hamas is going to turn over really what is day-to-day civilian responsibilities to the Palestinian Authority, but then there's not much beyond that. Can you explain to our listeners what exactly this deal entails?
So basically, the whole reconciliation thing is about giving power, or what they're calling empowering the PA in Gaza. So that's like giving the power for the PA in all Gaza and all around Gaza, like so that the PA has power over the all kinds of institutes inside the sect. But, and Hamas was fine with that until, you know, getting the PA into Gaza means security coordination, which is not good for Hamas as a resistance party. So that's what is getting in the way of having a successful reconciliation.
And let me ask you another question, too. If both Hamas and the PA have to rely on the Israeli government for things like the electricity or making sure that the water stays on, can we really trust that this is going to go somewhere, or is it window dressing that's going to allow the Israelis to continue to run operations in Gaza?
And before Amina answers, John, I just want to help the audience also remember that Gaza has been targeted over and over again.
Relentlessly.
War after war. There was the 2008, it started December 2008, right around Christmas, maybe the day after Christmas, the Israelis started bombing Gaza. That went on until about the third week of January. Then in 2010, again, another bombing. A big war. And then 2014 in the spring, I mean, in the summer of 2014, another massive assault. So what the Israelis are basically saying to the people of Gaza is, you had an election, the democratically, you know, it was considered a free and fair election, but the people voted the wrong way. They voted for Hamas. And as a consequence, Israel has made life hell for people, not only going to war against this densely populated part of the planet, but then refusing to allow people to rebuild, in other words, a siege.
And indeed, you've got other Arab countries, especially the Saudis and the Kuwaitis, who have been willing to finance a port, for example, or a usable airport, and they've been denied that permission by the Israelis.
Yeah. Amina, let's get your opinion on the context here. Of course, there's the administrative handoff by Hamas, in other words, saying, okay, Palestinian Authority will be, again, the authority. But the security forces on the ground, the military forces, they're still essentially Hamas military units, no?
Well, that's not quite true, because Hamas said that it's all about resistance and about keeping their arms or their guns. It's that they gave almost all the power for the PA. And even one of the PA members said that more than 50% on ground, the PA has power on ground in Gaza. So it's not about having military force. But, you know, Hamas, as I said, is a resistance movement and cannot just let go their power. and just not let us not forget that they have issued just a while ago their new document that shows how much they are trying to give away from what they used to have as a postulate in order to get a good reconciliation with the PA, such as they now, for example, recognize the 1967 territories. And that's something that Hamas did not do before, but they're doing so just because they want reach a reconciliation with or unity agreement with Fatah or the PA. And they were so clear that these weapons they have, it's only because they want to fight the occupation. They know they do not want to fight Fatah or any other Palestinian faction. So that's, I don't think that's quite true that they have military power. But still, the PA wants them to give away their weapons. They did not say so clearly, or they did not say that straightforward. But by saying that they should give away all the power that they have in Gaza, by saying that they should let the PA have all the power inside Gaza and let them have the security coordination inside Gaza, that means that they have to give away their weapons as well.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the major sticking points, or at least it's going to become one of the major sticking points. Both Al Jazeera and Middle East Eye are reporting that that Abbas has asked Hamas to disarm, and Hamas said it's not going to happen. At the same time,
they were not so clear about it because some of the Fatah members said that no, we did not say so. But just like 2 years, 2 days ago, Salah Bandawil, which is he's a Hamas member, he said that they discussed Hamas weapons, and they said it's a red line. It's not debatable even. So it's not quite obvious what happened in behind the lines, like about they are discussing this point at this time.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, John, we have the United States government, which gives a blank check, basically, to Israel. Israel can do anything it wants, and it goes to war endlessly against the people in Palestine, against the people in Gaza, against the people in Lebanon, threatens its neighbors. The Israelis still get, the Israeli government gets $4 billion at least per year from the U.S. government, making it the largest recipient of U.S. military aid. At the same time, Israel is committing war crimes against the people of Gaza and doing so with impunity. And in fact, the Obama administration gave the Israeli government an even larger, a decade-long sort of guarantee for more and more weapons, to which the Israelis complained that it wasn't big enough. I mean, that was Netanyahu actually criticized Obama.
Right.
I mean, it's very unusual. And the recipient of aid is saying, hey, you didn't give us enough.
He also complained that some of the fighter jets that we have sold to the Israeli government were not of the same quality as the jets we use for our own military, which is true. We always degrade them slightly just so that no matter what happens, we always have a leg up. And that's why, for example, we have the F-15E. E stands for Emirates, because that's the one we sold to the United Arab Emirates. We have the F-15I, which is exactly the same plane that we sold to the Israelis, et cetera, et cetera. But Netanyahu complained quite vociferously because he wanted exactly the same quality that we have for our own Air Force.
And now, Amina, you have Hamas trying to say, well, yes, we recognize the 1967 borders. The pre-1967 borders, in essence, that's a big concession. At the same time, the United States government still labels Hamas as a terrorist organization. Help the audience, the broader audience that may not be paying that much attention here in Washington, D.C. or the rest of the United States. You characterize Hamas as a resistance organization, that they have weapons because they're part of a resistance, where the U.S. and the Israeli government says, well, that's terrorism. Talk about the difference.
So So basically, the United States, the European Union, Israel, all marked Hamas and all the resistance factions or parties in Palestine as terrorist groups simply because they have weapons. Although this perfectly contradicts with international law that states clearly that any land under occupation has its people have the right to resist, including armed resistance. And so Palestinians admit that Palestine is under occupation, all of Palestine, including the territories that were occupied in 1948. But according to international law, they admit, international law or international community admits that there is occupation of in Palestine, which is the territories which were occupied in 1967, which gives legitimacy to the resistance movement in Palestine, including Hamas and all the others that hold guns in the face of the occupiers. So this is a significant difference. I mean, terrorism is just holding guns because you want to terrorize people. You want to just, you know, get rid of people. This is terrorism. But, you know, Hamas and all other Palestinian factions do not do so. They don't even kill civilian, settlers in Palestine. And we have, you know, some attacks happened a while ago where Hamas, some of the Palestinian factions, I'm not sure if it's where Hamas or not, but they killed the soldiers and there were kids with them. They did not kill the kids. So this show, unlike Israeli army that kills and bombs anyone in Gaza, or they killed, you know, many kids were killed just during this year. So that's terrorism. But what is happening and what Hamas and other factions are doing, holding guns in front of occupiers, this is terrorism. And even it's not defined as terrorism in the concept of international law or any other law.
Okay, we're gonna have to move on, John. Thank you, Amina. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very, very short break, we'll be right back with the top stories of the day. You are listening to Amina El Ashkar. She is a political analyst and part of the North America Nakba tour. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.